Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 59 of Season 7 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is my good friend Alan Sanders of The Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back to my show, Alan.
Thank you so much. Great to be back on a Thursday here with you. Every day in this movie is just a joy to talk about. It's one of the greatest franchises, I think, of all time, at least the first three. And to be able to spend time breaking it down like this is just so much fun.
And I appreciate you joining us for that. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. All right. So minute 59 begins with Carl acting in awe and ends with John asking for some instructions. So yesterday we left things with, Simon and his men getting help from Katya to get rid of the last federal guard trying to, that's in their way. And then they enter the vault itself and we get a big panning shot of the vault, which I didn't mention this yesterday, but I think it's great how this really fits in well with the Gruber brother heist acts, because like in the original Die Hard, we also get a great panning shot of the vault as it's like opened and as it's first revealed to us. So they do the same thing here, by revealing it to us that way. And I think it's great what they do here. Mm-hmm. So this minute begins with Carl, looking around and basically saying, "God, it's Fort Knox." So, I mean, we talked earlier in the season about the fact that the difference between Fort Knox and here. So we don't really need to go into that again. But what's interesting is first of all, as he's talking, we can actually see the official name of Luxembourg behind him. Do you know what mm-hmm. the official name of Luxembourg is?
Do I know what the official name of Luxembourg?
Yeah.
No.
Luxembourg, the official name is the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. That's the official name of
fourth day with you coming back. And I'm like, okay, there's nothing I'm going to learn new today. And I just learned, I didn't know that was the full name of Luxembourg.
Well, again, if you look in the back behind Carl, you can see the plaque that says the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg.
Well, I didn't. Okay. Well, is it the name? You just said it like it's a fact. That's the name of the country. Is it somebody that is the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg? Is this some queen or some royalty? Is that the name?
No. The official name of the country of Luxembourg is the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg.
I can honestly say in my 50 plus years revolving around the sun, I never, ever heard that. I've only ever heard it called Luxembourg.
Okay, so a Grand Duchy is a country or territory whose official head of state or ruler is a monarch bearing the title of Grand Duke or Grand Duchess, meaning it's not a king. It's not a kingdom. It's a duchy.
Right. Gotcha. So it technically does relate to somebody in royalty, but not as high as a king.
Correct.
Interesting.
Correct. And Luxembourg is the only country in the world today that still remains a Grand Duchy.
Okay.
There were a lot of others, but that's also where a lot of places have the title of dukes and stuff like that. You have the Duke of Burgundy. So that was the Grand Duchy of Burgundy at the time, things like that.
Gotcha. Well, now it's its own country versus a territory within a bigger country.
Correct. But it's its own country, but it's still the only country that is still known as a Grand Duchy. So
that's wild. Wow. Thank you, Rob. Not only have you taught me something, but you helped the rest of the audience know just how uninformed I really am.
Well, even Finland used to be a duchy. It was a grand duchy between 1809 and 1917.
Okay.
Because it was an autonomous state that was ruled by the Russian Empire. So again, it's an autonomous area that's ruled by some other country. Luxembourg at this point is not. It's the only one that still remains its own. So yeah, I thought I would enlighten you about that.
That's
As
wild.
you know, as Carl is in awe about it being like Fort Knox. And
What I love about this, and I know you're going to get to it, we'll get more toward the end, but whenever we hear that term, that I think that's just synonymous with where gold is kept. Like even as a kid growing up, you just heard that phrase. Well, you keep the gold at Fort Knox. So
correct.
even this guy makes the reference to the thing that we all know. It's like Fort Knox. And I think it's going to be an interesting fact we learn later about the difference between your reserves and Fort Knox.
Correct. No, but it's funny because like Carl knows their plan. He knows why they're there. So, you know, it's funny for him to say it's Fort Knox. Excuse me. You should know that I've already told you that we're going to a place that has more than Fort Knox or whatever it is.
From a movie construction, though, I could honestly say a lieutenant who's going to be asked to do certain things, yes, it's a gold heist, may not have realized how much gold is in the reserve. I don't know that he would have that much detail. He's not exactly the head planner.
He trusts his boss, I guess you could say. Okay, makes sense. It's fair.
And it's a great line for the audience as well, because people like me that may not have realized the first time watching it that the Federal Reserves are a place to store gold, and yet we've all heard Fort Knox. So it actually, I think, is one of those lines that's it works with the character, but I think it's one of those very short lines that is there to help the audience understand what's happening here. You know, what is this like you're robbing? Everybody can in the audience would be like, "Holy crap, you're like robbing Fort Knox, but it's in New York City." And I like it because it keeps you like you're learning something new. I don't think a lot of people might have known, because I didn't at the time, that the Reserve Bank of New York would actually be a place where they store gold.
Okay, that's understandable. But again, the idea here is that this is a line that is for us. It's not for Simon.
Right,
You know,
right. I
Carl's line 100% is for us. So it makes sense. And then we get about 20 seconds of just a whole bunch of different shots of Simon and Targo. They're talking in whatever language they're going to talk in. I think, I mean, Targo is Hungarian, so maybe he's talking in Hungarian or whatever it is. So I don't know exactly what he says. And then we see this little tractor. It always reminds me of what Ellen Ripley was using in Aliens. This little tractor just like strolls down on top of the gold and comes in. Breaks through the door, breaks through the little gate.
Well, it's a skid steer. It's like a bobcat style skid steer. That's the kind of, if you go, you can rent these to do landscaping if you want. If you want to look at, I know a lot of people where I live, they may buy their own if they've got like a small farm or something, because it helps all around the. It's a treaded tractor that has the arms kind of like the mechanism from the arms have come from behind, so it uses the weight of the actual vehicle itself. If you're picking up something really heavy to help counterbalance the weight, but it's a different people make skid steers. Like you've got bobcats are the probably the biggest ones that people know, but yeah, I've seen these a lot. I have a buddy of mine who actually owns a
You know,
tree
ones this
removal.
small? The ones that are this small?
No, this is exactly what I've seen multiple times, especially in like I said, my buddy has a tree removal business, and after they get done. They'll bring their skid steer in and maybe help level off and regrade the area that they just removed trees. And so they use things just like this. Like it looks exactly the same as this. It's a skid steer.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Okay. I didn't even know what it was called. And then we see a bunch of different plaques of different countries that whose gold is in this reserve besides the one from the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg that we mentioned earlier. So we have Japan, and we see the Republic of South Africa, and we see Saudi Arabia, which is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Again, it's very interesting that they're using the official titles of these countries, on their plaques showing, you know, that this is where they store their gold, you know, that type of thing. And on each of these, we have somebody who hooks on like a chain to these actual places. And little by little, we see this skid steer, as you called it, just ripping the. Actually, there's a few of them probably.
I think yes. One shot, we see at least two.
Yeah, right. There's at least two.
There's a third one coming down. Actually, right around, oh my gosh, right around second 21 or 22, right 22 to heading into 23, you've got two that are pulling across the screen, and you see a third one now coming down in the behind where that the first one came down.
Right. So they are coming well prepared. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know exactly what they're doing here by pulling into this thing and just scooping up all those bars of gold. And then Simon turns to respond to Carl, who has said something, you know, at the beginning of the minute, and he goes, 140 billion, 10 times what's in Kentucky, Fort Knox, huh? That's for tourists.
That's a great line.
It's a great line.
That is a great Definitely line. Is. Like, if we're going to go through all this planning, we're not going to go to Fort Knox.
That's right.
And we go hang out, visit the shops, but we're not going to bother robbing Fort Knox. It's not worth our time.
That's right. All right. So $140 billion in either 1994 or 1995, depending on when this movie takes place. How much do you think that's worth today?
Oh, with inflation of the last few years?
That's correct.
I'm going to go with probably double that, like $280 billion.
And you would be correct. So if this takes place in 1995, so the $140 billion is worth $288 billion today. And if it takes place in 1994, that $140 billion is worth $296 billion. So again, it's a difference of $8 billion. That's a lot within just 1 year of the amount of inflation. You know, that's just crazy. Now, I didn't do the math because I'm not a math person, but I'm curious as how many gold bars they would have there if it's $140 billion. You know, if we know that each gold bar is actually, we don't even know the worth of it at the time.
We know the worth today. Today's worth, we calculated that. I remember calculating like it was something like $25,000 a bar. Right?
Okay.
It's like a little over 24,000, but I rounded up to $25,000 a bar. So you said 100 and would well, be 280 40, what?
296 billion.
$296 billion. Three more zeros divided by 25,000. That would be 11,840,000 bars of gold.
Wow, that's a lot, and that's why it doesn't matter to them if they miss a few here or there along the way.
Right.
that's just not as important. Yeah, that's just crazy.
All of those. And it explains why they need all the dump trucks.
That's right. That's right. Because they had 14 dump trucks that they stole. So, yeah. So, wait, so how much? 11 billion something. So, divide that. So, they have a little less than a billion in each dump truck. Yeah. Which actually comes into play later. But yeah.
Yeah.
Because, just imagine, there is a point where. How many trucks? Right.
How many trucks do they have? 14?
14.
By 14. That means each truck is carrying 845,714 bars if they got them all.
Right.
That's a lot of bars of gold. that's a lot of weight in those trucks.
That's right. Interesting. I'm trying to remember where it talks about how much there. Simon later on says how much money is in the back of here. He says there's $13 billion in the back of the truck. So I don't know. So that, well, that
13 times that, 14 truck, that's $182 billion. If each truck had the same amount.
Right. Which, okay, maybe. So which whatever. Weird, I mean, it's still nice to say 13.
What he just said.
That's right.
Because here he's talking about $140 billion, but technically, and maybe he's just rounding in his head as well, but it's a lot of money.
Or maybe he thinks that there's 140, but when they actually go through it, they realize that they have much more than that.
Ah, right. There was a recent deposit, and they hadn't finished putting it all up. which is why it was all on those little carts earlier, or the tables and the pallets.
That's very, very possible. But again, the organization here is unbelievable.
Right.
You know,
it just, for a side comment, what's bananas is you start looking at this. Okay, this room, one reserve, 140, maybe it's 180, but you know, converted for inflation for today, 280 or 296 billion. And our government will drop $1 trillion at the drop of a hat and not think twice about it.
Correct.
That's, I can't even wrap my mind around how much wealth that actually is.
Yeah, neither can I. It's just, it's the numbers beyond comprehension.
Right. You cannot really understand or fathom what that amount really references, what it means. Like, you can't think of it tangibly as, look at all this gold, every bit of this in one of these reserves, bigger than Fort Knox. And it's only today's value, 290. So we'll round it to 300 billion. And the U.S. debt as of right now today adds about $1 trillion via interest every 100 days.
So in other words, the money that's in the gold that's in Fort Knox and in the Federal Reserve isn't going to be able to help.
Isn't going to help for 100 days of interest. Nope.
No.
That's now you guys know why I do what I do. That's my daily show.
That's right. And then the final shot that we get to see in the reserve is there's actually a whole bunch of these what do you call them? These skid steers. There's probably about six or seven of them. You know, so I never even paid attention to the fact that there were so many of them. I always saw the first one, you know, breaking the pile of bricks, and then I never thought about the fact that there's a whole bunch of them, you know, scurrying around through the rest of the minute.
And what I love is in that background shot before we come outside to the other subplot, is you see that there is a convoy of them going out as new ones are coming in. So you get the sense of, like you said, there's several, and it's very organized. Come in, grab a load, go out, go, you know, dump it in the dump truck, come back in, grab the next load. It's very much on a conveyor belt here.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's amazing how much work is going into this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the crazy thing here. Wow. Unbelievable. And then the shot changes, and we're outside, and we have McLean and Zeus running into the park, and we hear in the distance a phone that's ringing. And, you know, it's nice to see that they're actually running at this point, because before, when we saw them moving towards here, they were just jogging. You know, they weren't running. Just a little bit of, they were going at a good pace, but now they must realize that they're running short on time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're running in, trying to find where the actual phone is ringing. And they eventually find the phone. And I mean, they do a great job here with the cinematography. You know, having the camera zoom back and forth, you know, just show, you know, to make us feel the chaos that they're feeling right now, that they don't know where this phone is, but they hear it ringing. You know, nobody else in the park hears it ringing. Only they hear it, because that's the way it works in movies. Only the protagonist will hear, you know, the phone ringing in the distance.
Right. Well, and then, you know, typical New Yorkers, I ain't answering. It's not for me.
That's right.
It's not my phone. I do like the rapid pans or camera moves where everything is so blurred. It's not a slow move to keep everything in focus, which adds to that sense of distortion, that sense of, you know, panic. Where's the phone? Where do we, you know, it does add very well to that sense of urgency.
Yes, for sure. For sure. And then John answers the phone and goes, McLean. And then we hear on the other hand, John, you're out of shape. You barely made it. And you know, we can even see John shaking as he's talking. And then he basically says, yeah, well, we all barely made it. What do you want us to do? And you know, it's great that there's one of the things I've always loved about John McClane is that they don't mind in the movie showing his vulnerability. You know, he's not a perfect character. He's not a perfect action hero. You know, he gets tired. You know, he's running to catch the phone, and he's panting. He's out of breath. He's still making his jokes, but he's still your everyman. I guess that's what it comes down to.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because I love the fact that when we're pausing and looking and talking about continuity, for the makeup people to have detailed pictures of how they've applied the various injuries, because they didn't shoot it in order. And so you have to know, just kind of like the first Die Hard, which I loved, is he gets more beat up, more injured, more dirty as he goes along. It's very similar in this movie, which I do like that kind of parallel. He's getting more gritty, more bloody, more wounded. You know, he's got bruises, he's got scrapes, he's got blood drying. And I actually love that element of these movies, but specifically 1 and 3, I think, do it the best.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I definitely agree with that, because of the way that he, deals with these type of things. He takes a licking and keeps on ticking.
Right. But it also it's an indication that it's happening in real time. There's not giant amounts of time happening in between events.
Correct. Correct. And I mean, that's with all the Die Hard movies. It's all happening in succession. We don't have months or days or even hours between the events. Everything is one after the other continuing to happen here.
Right.
Which they do really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
No, I think once again, there's not a lot of dialogue happening in these minutes, but there's a lot of camera work. There's a lot of physicality. There's a lot of that militaristic precision that you mentioned and that we've mentioned a couple of times this week, showing us visually where they don't have to tell us. We don't have to have a montage of them training for this mission. We sense how well prepared they are and how organized they are just by these kinds of setups and shots that. It really helps visually tell that part of the story without having to, have a narrator or a voiceover or a montage. We just can tell from the shots.
Yeah. And it's great because it show they really are so prepared.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on, to have either 6 or 7 of these skid steers, to do their work. It's just
right.
It means they knew in advance what they needed to make sure they would have.
And then the nice thing about it, once again, you're borrowing this equipment from a project. A skid steer would be something anybody, even in New York, you're going to see these all over the place, because these are smaller sort of bulldozers, if you will. But they're smaller vehicles for doing small jobs like you would expect anywhere in a park, in a construction site, anywhere. So it wouldn't look out of place if somebody was driving one even through a quad or a sidewalk or, around a corner of an alleyway because they were doing some work. You just wouldn't even think it's not out of the ordinary.
Right. Exactly. All right, great. So the script, there's just a little part of the script, but the script starts off a pallet of gold bars as the bucket of a skid steer rams into it, and we widen into the main vault of the bank. Simon's men are scooping up the huge pallets of gold bars. They move the gold like gravel or rocks, with emphasis on speed. Bars are clanging on the ground. Skid steers laden with gold bars roll up to a dump trucks and empty their loads. Simon and Targa watch from the platform. Simon looks at his watch. So, that's just great the way that they do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they talk about here in the script. So, every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Revenge / Sibling Rivalry Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure. Something's happened to them over the course of their life that is related to either sibling rivalry or revenge. So, Alan, you got a story for us?
Well, I'm going to try to keep it more light, because there was a point in time I thought my job was to kill my younger brother because I have 3 younger brothers. But initially it was me and my one brother, who's only 2 years younger than me. It was supposed to be just, according to my mom and dad, the plan was just to have the two of us. And I remember having the family meeting where my dad said, well, your mom went to the doctor and we discovered something. It looks like we're going to have a little addition showing up. And this is where my brother and I were older. We're like, OK, so it was a 7-year gap. And my mom and dad at that decided it was such a big gap. They were like, well, we don't want this third child to be raised almost like a single child. There's such a difference that they knew at that point they were planning to have then another one, so that way the two of them could grow up together. So that's how we end up with, I end up with three total brothers, four total boys in the family. But my one brother, because I was the oldest, and in during the summer, and this was during the time of to go back in history, you know, the late 70s, the Carter era, where we had the energy crisis, we had a lot of layoffs, especially my living in Detroit. The auto industry took a big hit, and everything is kind of connected in and around the auto industry. So my dad had to take these short tours of duty. He was still with the military as a reservist, couldn't find any work, was on unemployment. Things were really tight. As a kid, I didn't realize a lot of that. I know looking back now how stressed they must have been. Because here they had two boys, and then they had decided to have two more, and suddenly, you know, you've doubled the size of your responsibilities, and then all of a sudden you're out of work. So my dad had to take these tours of duty, and he would go for 6 months at a time at some fort around the country. Often he'd be gone for 6 months straight, and we wouldn't see my dad. And so I became sort of like the dad of the house, because someone had to be there to watch the younger brothers. So I learned how to change diapers on my younger brother. I learned how to bottle feed. I learned how to jar feed. I learned how to babysit. I did everything because my mom had to go to work. She had to do something to help supplement the family. So when summer would roll around, I used to be so angry because I was expected to stay home every single day, where my brother, 2 years younger than me, he could go play all day. He could get on his bike, go play with his friends. He could be gone all day while my mom's at work. I was responsible for taking care of two younger brothers. And at the time, I'm like 10. Okay, just imagine today's society. You're leaving a 10-year-old to be responsible for a 3-year-old and a less than 12-month-old.
Wow.
So I'm literally taking care of a baby and a toddler. I'm having to feed them, change them, having to play with them all day. I was expected to start dinner and have potatoes peeled or something so it'd be easier when my mom came home. I resented my second brother down because there was no expectation for him to help. None. I was the oldest. It was my responsibility. I was told, this is your job. You're the older brother. You're the one who's got to stay home. And I thought my job was, I'm going to kill this kid because he gets to go play and I have to work. And I was really angry for a while at him, and probably rationally for a 10, 12-year-old, you know, and for that couple of years, my dad was back and forth. But looking back, even though I had this intense anger at him, and I just, it was so resentful for that period of time. I'm actually, when I look back and as I got a little bit older and wiser, I am so thankful that I was able to do what I did when I did it. It got me, I knew I was ready to be a dad when I was. I was never panicked about being a dad. I loved every minute of it. And ironically, you know, we just, you know, a month ago from when this came out, just about maybe less than a month, was Father's Day. And every time Father's Day rolls around, I just think how much that's something I've wanted to be my whole life. And I don't know how influenced I was, but I'm really kind of happy, even though I was very angry about it for a couple of years. I think it, and to this day, there's no greater role I've ever played. There's no job I've had of more importance to me than being a dad. And so it started off as rivalry, or maybe actually just sibling, just disgust. I was just so angry at him, but I'm kind of glad, being the oldest, I got that experience that he didn't get. And I got to be able to say, and still to this day, I value learning that I could do that. If I could do that at 10 and then 11 and 12 years old until things kind of settled down, my dad got a real job and I've got another full-time job, which relocated us to Georgia. It helped me see, look at what you're capable of. Look at, you know, you're 10 and you're changing diapers, you're bottle feeding, you're taking care of, from the time, you know, mom leaves for work till 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening, you're the one responsible. And this is before cell phone. This, you know, you didn't have any of this instant communication. There was no security camera where my mom could check in and see how things are going, you know?
Oh, wow.
I hated my brother at the time because I felt like, I felt like I was being punished. But looking back, it was one of the best things that could have been asked of me, because it got me prepared to not only be an adult, but to be a dad.
Wow. Okay. So now I have a question about how, you know, looking back now, so how did you think that affected your brother for him? I mean, has he become a parent?
Yeah. And he has only one kid. He said from the very beginning, he goes, I know what it was like with you being in charge and having multiple brothers. I know what it was like. And and I don't want to have that kind of responsibility. And his wife was like, I don't even think she wanted a kid, but it happened. And so they said, we're just having the same, just one kid. And that's all they have. I told him, I said, you're not technically a full parent yet. And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, well, you're not really a full parent. You're kind of a semi parent. He goes, I have a kid. I'm a parent. He goes, nah, you haven't had to have the conversation about you come home, find something broken, and you got to try to figure out which of the two did it. See, if you come home and something's broken, you know who did it, right? You can't blame it on another sibling. So you don't get to, you're missing out an entire wing of parenting, you know, woes and angst. And then you start adding three and four kids. Now it becomes it's a whole level of parenting different than a single child.
Oh, wow. No, I totally agree. I'm aware of that. But
yeah. Now, on the flip side, what he's told me, he said, I wish we had now looking back. He's told me looking back, they wish they had another kid because he said, I became the only thing my son knew to come play with. So there were days I'd be like, just, I want to sit down. I don't, but for him as a kid, he's like, well, come play with me. Let's go outside. Let's go do this. Let's go. So he said, I kind of was like the older, I was the parent, but I was like the play pal because he was by himself and he didn't want to play by himself all the time. So there is that. That's why I loved having multiple kids because they could play with each other and take care of each other, which is kind of nice.
All right. Very cool. All right. Great. Thank you very much for that. So, Alan, would you like to tell everyone once again where they can find Alan Sanders?
Sure. You can find you can find my daily show. I do a daily digital podcast. I actually do it via a radio station. My quote flagship is WSB in Atlanta, one of the longest running radio stations since the advent of radio. So you can actually find it there, wsbradio.com/The Alan Sanders Show. But if you like listening on your podcatcher, you use Apple, you use Google Play, Podbean, Podomatic, whatever, just do a search for The Alan Sanders Show. It's a news talk, very heavily politics, what's happening in the world of U.S. politics. And so I do that every single weekday. You just look for The Alan Sanders Show. If you want to engage on social media, I'm on Facebook, X, Instagram, Getter, and Truth Social. But I'm probably most active on X. So if you you follow me and you want to DM me, you want to have a conversation, you can even disagree as long as we're civil. I enjoy having conversations with people all the time. And I love trying to get new angles to every issue out there. And I'm always willing to talk to somebody.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to shoot me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, Alan, you feel like coming back in tomorrow to find out what new task John and Zeus might get?
Yeah, you know what? I'd like to just go ahead and round out the week. I mean, I've been here 4 days already. Why not just cap it off?
All right. Excellent. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Johnny comes marching home again. Hurrah, hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hurrah, hurrah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout. The ladies, they will all turn out. And we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.